Film Spotting is brought to you by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting and buy the hit new series Veronica Mars, Season 2, now on DVD. Veronica is a smart and fearless 18-year-old private investigator apprentice dedicated to solving tough mysteries in the seaside town of Neptune. Discover Veronica Mars, Season 2, now on DVD.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Sam Van Halgren.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. On tonight's show, our review of Snakes on a Plane and a conversation with Ryan Johnson, the writer-director of our favorite film of the year so far, Brick.
Plus, Massacre Theater, music from the Black Heart Procession, and Girls Against Boys, and this week's Top 5, the most arrogant and misguided Top 5 theme in the history of film spotting, Film Spotting University, the 5 films we want every young filmmaker to see. But first, let's take a little road trip with Little Miss Sunshine.
I couldn't help noticing Dwayne has stopped speaking.
Oh, yeah, he's taken a vow of silence.
Cheryl, remember when Olive was runner-up in the regional Little Miss Sunshine? Well, the girl who won had to forfeit her crown. I don't know why, something about diet pills, but anyway. Now she has a place in the state contest in Redondo.
We're going to California.
Sam, let's meet the Hoovers. You've got Uncle Frank, a suicidal Proust scholar. Dad Richard is a helpless self-help speaker. Angst-ridden teenage son Dwayne doesn't talk. 7-year-old daughter Olive is an aspiring beauty queen. Mother Cheryl, her only real peccadillo may be that she is actually too supportive of her misguided flock. And who among us doesn't have a crass, heroin-snorting grandpa? It's really tempting to label Little Miss Sunshine a movie about a quirky, dysfunctional family on a road trip, as you said, but then that's how you could describe almost any independent film, including a movie you tore apart back on episode number 77 of our podcast, Transamerica. You shredded Transamerica for the clumsy way it mixed, and I quote, "gross examples of sentimentality with indie anti-sentimentality cliché." Little Miss Sunshine is full of sarcasm and irony, but also has tender, emotional moments that could prompt the same criticism. Does husband and wife team Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris, making their feature film directing debut, commit the same sins that fellow first-timer Duncan Tucker did with Transamerica?
Well, yeah, as you said, my problem with Transamerica was that every character, every situation, seemed to be pulled from the great big book of movie cliches and movie cliche characters, the conventional Hollywood volumes and the indie movie volumes, and still wanted to be taken seriously about a movie about a marginalized group of people, and I found that totally insulting. You're right, yes. Little Miss Sunshine is, as you said, pretty standard indie fare. The misfit road movie, we get a bunch of good actors, take a pay cut, spend a couple of weeks in a stuffy car, each is assigned their quirky trade and bingo, you've got your Sundance hit. But unlike Transamerica, I mean, it's really not trying to pretend that it's anything but what it is. It is a road trip comedy with this built-in message about your family being your family, like it or not, nothing revolutionary there. But this movie's getting some major hype now. It was a massive hit at Sundance Film Festival, and there's a sense that this movie is different somehow. And I know when I started seeing the trailers this spring, I was really excited about it. It looked really fun. It had a great, great cast of my favorite actors. It looked, you know, quirky and fun and stylish. And so it's really surprising, honestly, that this movie rubbed me the wrong way almost from the very beginning. Yeah. And I think my big problem with it was that the directors, Dayton and Harris, wanted to create this world where we believe that this eccentric family can exist and this wild road trip full of incident and coincidence and slapstick can occur, but it also wants us to believe in the characters as real people with real feelings and real stakes in the outcome. And for me, they failed. And I think in order for these two worlds to coexist, the actors seem to have been directed to give performances that struck me as, I may be coining a term here, but pseudo-sincere. I just never believed them. I never believed them as real people, as anything more than the sum of their quirks. And of course, the major exception here is Abigail Breslin, Little Miss Sunshine herself, as Olive, who's the very picture of sincerity, and every moment she's on screen is honestly just a complete pleasure. But everyone else, it's not just that they're quirky. They're mean, they're bitter, they're depressed or depressing, and they don't like each other, and I didn't really like them, and I know I'm in the minority. I mean, everyone I've talked to that's seen this movie has loved it, and that's why it really did surprise me. But everyone else likes spending time with the Hoovers. I did not.
Yeah, you're absolutely crazy on this one. And with Transamerica, I was put in the tough position of kind of defending that movie. And I will admit, it's the one time in the history of this show, all the reviews we've done, where after it was done, I really felt like, wow, Sam may be right on that one. I'm gonna have to rethink how I looked at that film, because you made a lot of really good points. But this film is far better than Transamerica. And the one thing you got right is that Abigail Breslin, as the 7-year-old Olive, is incredible.
Yeah,
you're right.
Is.
There isn't a wrong moment from her, a wrong note throughout this entire film. She's really incredible. And I even tried picturing during some of those scenes another child actor being that character and how she would approach it. And I just can't believe how much she got everything right, because I think it could have been so wrong. And she's amazing. But I don't agree at all that the other characters are pseudo sincere. This is a movie about weird, quirky characters, but I don't think it really exploits their quirks. It's not about emphasizing them. I think these filmmakers really love and respect these characters. I think you once again just had way too happy a childhood, I think is the problem.
Honestly, I think you're right.
Maybe you did. They are terribly flawed, but they all contain, you know, greatness or have things about them to respect. And it's mainly a compassion for each other, even if that's ridiculously hard to see sometimes and it doesn't come through. And you've talked a couple times recently, actually, about the way certain directors frame a character in a safe way. And I got to be honest, I never really understood what the hell you were talking about, but I understood it somehow. It clicked for me watching this film, because even in the most ridiculous comedic scenes, they're shot so straightforward in a way that feels natural and not about, again, kind of emphasizing those quirks and showing how weird these people are. It's not, for example, the way Oliver Stone shoots the Marine Dave Carnes in World Trade Center. We talked about kind of exploiting his Christianity and making him into a weird character. I love that this is a movie about characters going through change, but unlike a lot of indie and Hollywood movies, where they come out at the end isn't drastically different from where they started. It's very subtle. I mean, if you ask yourself, if they make a sequel to Little Miss Sunshine, by the end of this movie, even though it ends on a happy note and everyone seems to be getting along, are they really going to be a much different family than they are right here? I don't think they are, and I love the fact that it didn't choose to manipulate us like that, and we just understand them kind of going forward with life. You know, I think it is kind of about those little victories we see in the film and the little changes, and they're still going to be dysfunctional, flawed human beings, and I like that.
Yeah, well, I guess I think you're right to maybe point out the fact, maybe what others have pointed out in terms of like what's the movie, what's the type of movie that Sam doesn't like, and it's the kind of movie where it's like kind of bad, unlikable people doing sort of bad, unlikable things to each other.
Uh-huh.
And for me, like, I just, by the end of this film, I was just feeling bad. I just didn't like spending time with them. So I have to examine, like, the movie. What did the movie do to make me feel that way? Because every character I love, again, I can't stress enough how much I like these characters. You know, Alan Arkin, Greg Kinnear, Toni Collette, Steve Carell. I mean, all of them great comic actors and performers, and each of them have moments in this film that are really wonderful and priceless, and they're totally using their gifts mm-hmm. of charm but at the end of it, again, I'd lost patience with them. And Alan Arkin's part particularly, who does play this grandpa who keeps his heroin in his fanny pack, which is a wonderful idea. I mean again one of my favorite actors, honestly. And I didn't like him. I didn't like spending time with him. I didn't like having him in the car, because he's really just this old profane man. And again, he has a few moments where he shows us a different side, but it's just, he just seems so defined by that element. And I didn't like spending time with him.
Okay.
And I didn't like spending time with the rest
of
the characters
either. I
don't agree.
I think Alan Arkin in particular is a character who, yes, at first he comes off as this guy who is just this obnoxious, crass, you know, maybe even bigoted, kind of stereotypical grandpa mm-hmm. in a way. And then what you find out is he's got great moments of tenderness, not only with Abigail Breslin, but he obviously has great compassion for Olive and is her best friend, which you wouldn't expect from his character. And then he has a great moment later with his son where he says something to him that I actually think the movie misses an opportunity, because it doesn't show us the wife's reaction to that moment. There's a moment where his father comes to him, comes to Greg Kinnear, and tells him he's proud of him in really his lowest moment, just after his wife has gotten through berating him and mm-hmm. really making him feel bad for failing. And there's not that moment where, frankly, after listening to the grandpa say that to her husband, she should have felt bad, and I think the movie missed an opportunity there. So I like those moments where Alan Arkin shows a little bit of depth and there's some complexity to his character. The bottom line, though, on the film, Sam, we talk about this all the time with comedies, does it make you laugh? This is a comedy, and it made me laugh a lot. There are hilarious scenes in this film where the dinner table scene, for example, the one we've seen in the trailer, unfortunately, right. They show too much of it, because they almost show the entire scene in the trailer. But That scene rivals the other great dinner table scene from this summer, the Talladega Nights dinner scene, I think. And there's a moment where Paul Dano, who has decided to take a vow of silence, he hasn't spoken in 9 months, Steve Carell comes in, he's just tried to commit suicide, and they have to share a room together, and he actually scribbles on his little notepad, "Please don't kill yourself tonight," and everybody in the theater lost it. I still laugh about it. I tell people about it. And, you know, sometimes when you try to describe moments in movies that you think are hilarious, you really have to be there. Everybody I tell that to laughs at that, when they just think about that guy writing, "Please don't kill yourself tonight," you know, in my bedroom. And Greg Kinnear, again, I've joked with you about it already, but I went with a friend of ours, Kevin, and we still laugh at him in one scene where a cop pulls him over and there's some porn magazines involved, and Greg Kinnear has to act like they're his. He has to act like they're his, and he says, "Oh, sweet, sweetness."
It's the best he can do.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's just like that's all he can muster because they're not really his, and he doesn't know how to act like, "Oh, yeah, I love porn," and that's his way of doing it. I think the movie's really funny.
And I guess for me, ultimately, it wasn't that funny. And my problem is that it seems cynical in some way, and I think because... and I read this, that the film was written about 10 years ago, and the directors have been trying to get this film made for years and years and years. And in a strange way, and I never would have thought this unless I knew that bit of information, it feels dated in some way, in this way, that I feel like we live in an age now where, you know, that sincerity is almost an act of rebellion. And I think of the films like Wes Anderson, but also the Frat Pack movies, you know, like Old School and Anchorman, where we have movies that ultimately are about friendship in some way. And to spend an hour and a half, and again, I know I'm alone, it seems, but to spend an hour and a half with people that really dislike each other intensely, particularly Greg Kinnear and Toni Collette, I don't like spending time with that married couple who have only bitterness and anger for each other, and there's rarely a moment.
If you think
where
those people don't like each other, Sam, you're missing the point of the movie completely. I really think that. And the only knock I'll have against the film, the only thing I can really say is there are a couple moments that fall into that category of indie movie moments where the screenwriter and the directors need characters to be in a certain situation because they have a certain joke or a certain plot line to explore that doesn't actually mesh with what their characters would do. There's something real small I'll mention where Greg Kinnear lets her drive their
van. That's exactly what I'm thinking.
Even
of.
Though she doesn't know how to drive a stick and he's really tired and he just wants to get to where they're going, you would never let someone, right, especially, you know, your wife, again, who doesn't know how to drive this stick, drive that, and exactly what happens, the clutch burns out. Well, the fact of the matter is, the movie just could have had the car break down.
Right.
You didn't actually need to have this concocted thing where she ends up driving the car. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense, and there are a few moments like that, and there are a couple of stale jokes, too. There's a scene with Steve Carell where he runs into his former lover.
Another example,
and this whole
exactly.
thing with the porn magazines that you see coming 100 miles away, right, and it ends up then being not funny at all because it's so telegraphed. So there are a few of those little moments in it, but again, the ensemble, the acting, I think, is uniformly good, and the movie made me laugh. So,
I have to say, it felt like, you know, when a bunch of friends of yours say, like, "Oh, you got to meet this guy. You'll love him. He's funny. He's just great." And then you meet him, and all your friends love him, and you're like, "God, this guy just drives me bananas."
Yeah, it happened
and
with me and you.
That's exactly. That's us. That's our relationship, in fact. All right. Well, if you've seen Little Miss Sunshine and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. We may not get a chance to respond, but we will definitely read your email.
After the break, acting so bad we could have been cast in Snakes on a Plane, we'll play another round of Massacre Theater and discuss the most hyped summer movie, possibly, Sam, of all time, yeah, Snakes on a Mother Effing Plane. Stay with us.
Is there any special country you want to go to?
Wyoming.
No, Wyoming. That's not a country. That's all right. I'm going to take care of it.
Welcome back to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio. With Sam Van Hallgren, I'm Adam Kempinar. It's time for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where we absolutely ruin one of the greatest screenplays ever written, and you get a shot at a free DVD. For official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Last week on the Film Spotting podcast, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard coming out of the break from The Great Dog Day Afternoon, directed by Sidney Lumet, with Al Pacino and John Cazale, a tie-in with last week's top five true stories. Adam, reach into that Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Sean Lass in Nashville. Congratulations, Sean. Email feedback@filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
No, no, Miss Lamont, round tones, now let me hear you read your line.
Time now for this week's edition of Massacre Theater, Sam, and this ties in with our top five theme, Film Spotting University, and it actually runs a little bit counter to what we ended up doing with our list.
That's true.
Which we'll get into later in the show.
But go ahead and look at a syllabus at any
film school.
That's right.
This film is probably going to be on the list, and also if you look at just any list of maybe the top 10 greatest films ever made, we're totally giving this away, as if the performance
and
probably
then the
won't, but it's always going to appear on lists of the best films ever made, so that's kind of the tie-in here, the top five theme. And Sam, I believe that you started.
That's right.
I will give you the action.
All right.
And action.
Where are you going?
Oh, I don't know.
Shopping?
No.
Anywhere in particular?
I just thought I'd wander.
That's what I was going to do.
Oh, yes, that's right. I forgot. It's your occupation, isn't it?
Don't you think it's a waste for the two of us?
To wander separately? But only one is a wanderer. Two together are always going somewhere.
Oh, I don't think that's necessarily true.
And scene. How did Sean Connery,
oh,
Sam,
Sean
end
Connery.
Up in your performance?
Well done. Yeah, well, you're going to lead them astray.
I guess so. It is not the Untouchables.
Way to get them off the scent.
Okay, well, if you know what film Sam and I just massacred.
It's not a Scottish burr. It sounded
pretty close, Sam. But if you know what film we just massacred, email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on Film Spotting number 122 on Wednesday, August 30th. To listen, go to filmspotting.net.
Adam, this is Samuel L. Jackson. Now, you may know me from my roles in movies like Pulp Fiction, Star Wars, and The Incredibles, but I'm here today to make sure you go see a movie that holds a special place in my heart. That's right. I'm talking about Snakes on a Plane. I know that sounds crazy, but I don't give a damn, because Snakes on a Plane just might be the best motion picture ever made. It's that good.
And that's Samuel L. Jackson politely requesting that I go see his new movie, Snakes on a Plane. And Sam, who am I to say no to Sam Jackson?
I mean, he was nice enough to make a personal call.
I know.
Yeah, at least we could do is check out his movie. And just think, Snakes on a Plane could have been called Pacific Air Flight 121, as it was scheduled to, but thanks to Samuel L. Jackson's ingenious insistence that the movie retain its original campy title, we now have the phenomenon that is Snakes on a Plane. But every hype-fueled movie must have its day of reckoning, and that day has come. Adam, no one is going in to Snakes on a Plane expecting it to be good. In order to satisfy the hype, all the movie has to do is be as fun as the title of the movie promises it will be. Does it deliver?
Well, I know your answer to this question because this is one rare case where we've actually discussed our review before we ended up talking about it, which we usually don't do. We want to surprise each other, but circumstances conspired against us here, and we ended up talking about it. I know your answer, but I have to say I've really been wrestling with the answer to that question since I saw it.
How to answer that question.
As ridiculous as it sounds, because after all, it's Snakes on a Plane, but this is really a critic-proof movie. If you don't like it, you're the stuffy critic with no sense of humor. If you rave about it, you could just be trying to show how hip and edgy you are. You can, you know, relate to the kids, so to speak. So
you've critic-proof my criticism.
That's right, I have. So is it as fun as its name? Unfortunately, Sam, I have to say, I really do feel bad about it. I have to say the answer is no. I think I, and many of our listeners, were really hoping to see a movie that is so bad it's good. Something we did a whole top five show about, movies that are so bad it's good. One that is basically unintentionally hilarious. One where you can all get together like a Mystery Science Theater 3000 and make fun of it, make fun of a movie that takes itself too seriously. But this movie's called Snakes on a Plane, so it's not unintentionally funny because the filmmakers are in on the joke. And you watch it and you do realize that the movie is quite clearly trying to be funny, or at least fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's all intentional humor, and I'm sorry, but watching a bunch of CGI snakes bite people's genitals doesn't really make me laugh.
Or any other orifice they can find.
Exactly, and they do find them all. Yes, Chuck Klosterman on this. I recently mentioned how the writer Chuck Klosterman wrote in an Esquire article about this movie how it would be better off, it would actually be more fun probably, if they'd actually just left the movie called Pacific Air Flight 121 and kept it, you know, a lame PG-13 movie, and I think he's right. They should have left it Pacific Air 121, left it PG-13, so we could all sit there and laugh at how lame everything was and how they couldn't recognize their own campiness, how stupid they were to shoot a movie with Samuel L. Jackson called Snakes on a Plane, but not have him say, you know, I want these snakes off this mother effing plane. They had to go back and reshoot that, you know, because we brought it to their attention, the, you know, bloggers and
the
people out there.
Yeah,
so
insisted.
Instead, we've got this movie that's stuck in this kind of purgatory where, you know, between conventional thriller and Rocky Horror, and it never becomes transcendently bad, and instead is just sort of okay.
So you say.
Yes, I do.
And I disagree, barely. I mean, the fact is, I think this movie is camp. It's not so bad it's good, no, as some people may have desired it to be, but it's intentional. Its campiness is intentional, which honestly isn't usually my cup of tea. And I think of Rocky Horror, which you just mentioned, but then again, I think of the circumstances I saw Rocky Horror under. I think I may have been alone and watching it on video.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a reason they show this movie at midnight, you know, with people holding rolls of toilet paper.
And dressed up.
And dressed up. I mean, there's a reason for that. And I have to say, I'm not saying you need to see this under these special circumstances, but I will say, if you're going to enjoy it, and no, not everyone is going to enjoy it, but if you're going to, the likelihood that you're going to enjoy it is going to be increased dramatically if you go see it opening weekend, second weekend, with a crowd full of people.
I agree.
I did not have a full audience, and yet I still had a good time. And part of it, honestly, was the novelty of seeing, for me, a truly cheesy movie, full of unintentional comedy, honestly. And it's not something we usually make time for, bad movies,
no,
you know, on Film Spotting. And the novelty, honestly, never quite wore out its welcome for me. I was kind of enjoying myself, but not really ready to recommend the film until the moment...
You're such a lemming, Sam.
That they reshot, you know, with Samuel Jackson saying the now famous line, clearly reshot too, wonderfully. And I have to say, the theater and I was right along with them, hooted and cheered for the scene. And you're saying that people were expecting to do that, doing it because they
felt
were programmed
forced
to by marketing.
Felt forced.
I have to say it's completely organic. Some people may be going there and going through the motions. I don't think most people are.
Okay, well, I do have to say I saw it with a decent-sized crowd, but not a full crowd, and they cheered and clapped and laughed at all the right moments. They clapped at the title.
Because they were having a good time.
I guess so. They clapped at the title. They clapped at Sam Jackson's name. They clapped at the airplane, the snakes, the mother effing line. Every place where they should clap and cheer, where the marketers of this film wanted them to clap, they all clapped. But something really crystallized for me, Sam, the night after I saw it, which is when I went to see the movie Accepted, this new kind of college
comedy.
Yeah. I saw before it three trailers. One of them, the new Borat trailer, Sacha Baron Cohen, who's in Talladega Nights. And that trailer is maybe the funniest 3 minutes I've seen all year. Really, it is. Right. And then you've got trailers for The Covenant and Man of the Year. You've probably seen these as well. So here you've got Borat, hilarious, and really, it hit me right away. This should make anyone who wants to say Snakes on a Plane is funny feel ashamed. Really, it should, because it's that funny.
Now you're just insulting people.
And then, I know, I am, and it's going to get worse. And then you've got two movies that could be off the charts, I think, in terms of their unintentional comedy. Robin Williams in Man of the Year, a TV, kind of a Jon Stewart-type TV host who actually becomes president
directed
of the United States.
Directed by Barry Levinson, though.
I know
this
it's Barry Levinson.
This is somebody that knows political satire.
But it has that potential to go down the road of taking itself too seriously. And then you've got The Covenant, this teen movie where these characters are descended from famous ancestors in this little like Salem community or whatever, and they have witch powers. And there's a line in the movie where this one, you've seen it, haven't you, Sam?
Yeah.
Where this one actor says to his, you know, the girl he's dating, imagine having unbelievable powers, but the more you use them, the weaker you get. And it's so serious and so stiff. It's as if a mad casting agent took parts of Josh Hartnett and Keanu Reeves and formed the ultimate acting monster.
Non-acting machine.
So again, to sum up here, what's my point? Well,
you've insulted so many people in this 30 seconds.
Snakes on a Plane never legitimately made me laugh like Borat, and it never made me laugh at it like either of those two movies could do. And so instead, again, I'm stuck in the middle, not really having a good time.
We'll just have to find out what people think about Snakes on the Plane. I, for one, walked out of there, you know, having a good time. I honestly did. Sincerely, and I'm not saying that to kowtow to the internet millions that are frothing over this movie. I honestly had a good time, and I really was surprised. So...
Okay. Well,
all right.
Anyway, it is Snakes on a Plane. We want to know what you think about it, of course, and we have a poll question on our site, filmspotting.net. Make your voice heard. is Snakes on a Plane, as we heard Sam Jackson say, the best motion picture ever
possibly
made.
Possibly the best motion picture ever made.
The choices are.
The choices are Samuel L. Doesn't Lie, More Like Passenger 57, I Want My Mother Effin' Money Back, or Might Watch It on DVD. Might. I'm telling you right now, don't do that. If you're going to watch this movie at all, go ahead
go
and
see it in the theater.
Pay the $9 or whatever for the
My
theater.
Vote, of course, I'm with Passenger 57 is what I'm saying. It's more like Passenger 57. Yeah. So right. Anyway, well, we do want to know what you think. So check out the poll question or email us or send a short MP3 clip to feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail by calling 206-203-CINNA, 206-203-2463. We'd love to hear from you.
When Film Spotting returns... Ask any dope rat where their junk sprang, and they'll say they scraped it from that, who scored it from this, who bought it from so, and after four or five connections, the list always ends with the pin. We'll talk with perhaps the only man who can decipher that bit of dialogue, the man who wrote it, Brick, writer-director Rian Johnson. Stay with us.
Hello, podcast listeners. Time to announce this week's winner of the PureFlix DVD giveaway. And the winner is Elizabeth Jewerts from Long Island, New York. Congratulations, Elizabeth. Look for your copy of Apocalypse Now, The Complete Dossier, in the mail soon, courtesy of PureFlix. Sign up for a free PureFlix account now, and you'll be entered to win Noah Baumbach's debut, Kicking and Screaming, out this week in a Criterion Collection edition. Learn more at PureFlix.com/filmspotting or at filmspotting.net.
I have never listened to your show before a recent episode 118 in which I heard a blurb about Brick being your favorite movie of the year and that Rian Johnson would be featured on the show later in the month. I want to officially inform you that because of your show's attention to Brick, that as far as heterosexual love between men may extend, I now extend it to you both. And any disagreements I may have with either of you for future reviews are in advance forgiven.
You're listening to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio, and that was a nice voicemail from one of our listeners, Alex, at Wheaton College. And as he said there in the voicemail, he is in love with this movie, Brick, and he's already seen it 3 times on DVD, took the train from Wheaton into Chicago, into the city, to see it twice when it was in theaters. And I'm hoping that after our listeners hear our interview coming up here with Rian Johnson, they'll understand why the movie has sparked so much passion from people like Alex and from us.
Yeah, I mean, back in June, on our very first Chicago Public Radio edition of Film Spotting, we both named Brick the best movie of the year so far. And the film, in case you're not familiar with it, does mix this hard-boiled world of Dashiell Hammett with the Coen brothers' quirkiness and a little bit of David Lynch surrealism thrown in for some extra kick. It's available now on DVD, and we're extremely pleased to be able to share our interview right now with Rian Johnson.
We're here on Film Spotting with Brick writer-director Rian Johnson. Rian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, we're going to get into a lot of discussion of the movie Brick here, but I actually wanted to start by asking you about yourself a little bit. Where did you grow up? When did you know you wanted to be a filmmaker? And talk a little bit about maybe your experience going to USC.
Sure, yeah. I grew up in Colorado, but I've been in Southern California ever since junior high. And I was just kind of one of those awful, terrible kids that you want to kick in the head who just were running around with a video camera when they were little, as soon as they could hold it up. And I don't know, I've always just grown up making movies with my friends. I did it when I was a little kid, and then when I got into high school and figured out that you could get out of writing book reports by making movies about Hamlet and showing them to your teacher, I did that, and then went to film school, and then got out of film school, and it's kind of been a lifelong thing for me. And I don't know, the experience of making Brick was like, it was pretty wonderful in that, just because that is my filmmaking background. Like I didn't get into it doing commercials or doing music videos or TV or anything professional, I guess. It was always just grabbing a group of people and grabbing a camera and going out and making the movie. And that was like kind of the atmosphere on the set of Brick. So to have that be kind of the first experience at making a feature, it was, I don't know, man, it was pretty cool and kind of fitting. And on top of that, to be doing it back in my hometown and at my actual high school, you know, it was a bit of a head trip, I guess, you know.
But for listeners who haven't seen Brick yet and haven't heard us rave about it, maybe some new listeners tuning in, how do you describe it to people, and how did you describe it to people during that long time of trying to get the movie made?
that was the hardest thing, I think, when back in all those kind of 6 years between when I wrote the script and when we finally got to make it, when you would hand the script to someone and you had to give them like a quick little one line, you know, what it is, it's just, I mean, you say like, it's a film noir in high school, but that conjures up just these awful images of teenagers doing Bogart impressions and like a, you know, kind of like a Bugsy Malone type thing. The thing we finally ended up landing on is Chinatown in high school. That's like the dumb this meets that sort of thing. And even that, I cringe every time I hear it, you know, but sometimes you just need to say it quickly. So now I'm completely relieved that I can just, you know, that the movie is there to kind of speak for itself, hopefully speak a little more eloquently than I can about it.
Were you ever tempted to write another, more straightforward script and try to get that sold, or doing them simultaneously, or letting somebody else direct your script?
The temptation to, I mean, first of all, the temptation to have someone else direct it never came up, because the script was so weird. It wasn't like people were clamoring for it, like, you know, this would be a gold mine if we put Ridley Scott on this, you know, or something like that. It was the type of thing where I knew that the issue wasn't really my inexperience as a director so much. It was just the fact that it was a very, very bizarre script. In terms of writing something else, yeah, absolutely, man. I mean, there was that hit constantly, and I took a couple stabs at it even, but just nothing that I came up with really. It reached a certain point where I had had Brick in my head for so long, and kind of the mass of having to defend it, of people like saying this isn't going to work, or how is this going to work, and the fact that whole time I kind of had this thing in my head, and I was like, no, I think this actually will really work. And at a certain point, the longer it took, the more determined I became to just get it up on the screen so that somebody could see exactly how it was going to be executed in a way where certain people would like it.
You're listening to Film Spotting. Our guest is Ryan Johnson, whose debut film, Brick, is out now on DVD. And you talk a lot about that six-year, seven-year process of getting the film made, and of course, the troubles getting financing and, you know, actors dropping out. What I'm more curious about, though, and for our listeners that want to hear more about that, definitely check out the DVD commentary. What I'm really curious about is maybe how the film changed or evolved in those 7 years. How much of what was on the page initially was in the end product, and how much did your vision change over that time? How did it evolve?
Well, it's interesting. I just recently posted the shooting script and also the original novella that I wrote before the script. I posted them both up online on my website so people can go and download those and check them out. And it's interesting because I had to go back in and kind of proofread it and I had to reread it. And it's surprising how little the fundamentals of it, I think, changed from the original conception up to when we actually did it. There was no huge sea change in terms of how the thing was realized. There was some structural stuff. There was a lot of details that were changed for clarity and for length and whatnot. But overall, what's on the page at the beginning, it is pretty clearly translated to what's on the screen at the end of the day. I don't know. It's very weird for me going back and reading that original novella and having the images from the finished film in my head at this point, as opposed to having whatever I had in my head before the movie. It's kind of like making the movie has gelled them in that one specific way, and kind of odd, I guess.
I know everyone talks about the language in this film noir dialogue in this modern day setting, but I am really curious about, as well, the visual touches in the film, I think, are part of what make it so exciting. A lot of the jump cuts, the out-of-focus dissolve, we get that great kind of transition shot of Brendan's clock and the passage of time. None of those shots seem there just, you know, to be arty. They all make sense and add to the mood. And I'm wondering how many of those were planned from the beginning and how many of them just came out while shooting or in the editing room.
Thank you. I'm really happy to hear you say that. There was a lot of work that we did in the editing room. I mean, probably a bunch of what you're talking about was really meticulously planned out, like the, you know, like the garbage bag trash effects or the garbage bag effects going by, or the instance you said with the out of focus clock, or a lot of the more planned out, like the jump cut shot where Tugger punches Brendan and that it like does that dolly counter zoom in really quick. Those were really carefully planned out, but a lot of kind of the incidental jump cuts in it were not. Those were a product of the editing process. And what had basically happened was when I was visually planning the film, I was watching a ton of Sergio Leone. And, you know, he's the master of those long, you know, unbroken takes. And so I got this idea in my head that, all right, man, we're going to shoot all these in these long, unbroken single takes, and it's going to be, you know. And then we shot it that way, and then I cut the movie together, and it was way, way too long. And it was way too, you know, the pacing of it just dragged. I think to a large extent because of the nature of the material. I think because the material is taken from Dashiell Hammett, really, well, not taken, but it's very much inspired by Dashiell Hammett, which is, you know, his writing and his language is so staccato and so percussive and so much about economy. And when you take it and stretch it out in this, in that type of visual language, it just didn't pop. And so I went in and just started cutting out the boring parts of all the shots. And that's where those jump cuts ended up coming from. Necessity is the mother of jump cuts, I guess.
Well, we have one final question here for you, and I don't know how many times you've been asked it, but I'm sure if your fans got your attention, it's what they'd want to know, and it's what's next.
Oh, yeah. I've written a con man movie. It's a con man movie called The Brothers Bloom, and it's kind of a globe-trotting con man adventure. I'm so excited about it. It's I don't want to say too much about it, I guess, but it's really going to be fun. And it's similar to Brick in that it's kind of it's very much its own world, but it's also a much broader movie than Brick, and it's not quite as sealed up in its own reality. It's a little more open, I think. But the con man genre is one of my favorite film genres, and I'm terrified and excited to try and take a crack at it. Knock on wood.
How close are you to shooting that?
I think we're going to, again, I knock on wood one more time. We're going to shoot the beginning of next year if everything goes smoothly. And why shouldn't it?
You know? You go. Well, we're definitely looking forward to that. And again, we really appreciate your time. We have 20 more questions at least we'd love to ask you. But hopefully we can have you on the show another time, maybe when The Brothers Bloom comes out.
Absolutely. Thank you. And thank you so much for your support of the movie on the show and for your show in general. Force for good in the universe.
Time for one last quick break. When we come back, school's in session. Adam and I, with a little help from Ryan Johnson, assemble a syllabus for Film Spotting University. Back in a moment. When you cry, nothing in the lemma. Yeah, when you cry, spiders on your ceiling. Don't you know you don't you know nothing? Nothing satisfies. Nothing satisfies. Welcome back to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Van Halgren. Adam, let's take a quick minute and thank the bands responsible for the music you're hearing this hour, Black Heart Procession and Girls Against Boys and Touch and Go Records, Chicago's own Touch and Go Records. Both bands, along with countless others, will be playing the Touch and Go Records 25th anniversary Hideout Block Party weekend of September 8th through 10th. For more information on the Block Party and these bands, go to Touch and Go Records website, tgrec.com.
And just a couple of quick programming notes we wanted to mention. You can listen to Film Spotting right here on Chicago Public Radio the last Saturday of every month. Or if a month is just too long to wait for your Film Spotting fix.
I hope it is.
Yeah, you can subscribe and download our weekly podcast at filmspotting.net. Also wanted to mention that we're going to make the full Ryan Johnson interview. We actually had about a 25-minute interview that obviously we had to cut for the show. But we're going to make that full interview available as a special download next week on the podcast.
Top five musical crimes perpetrated by Stevie Wonder in the 80s and 90s go. Sub-question, is it in fact unfair to criticize a formerly great artist for his latter-day sins? Is it better to burn out than to fade away?
It is top five time here on Film Spotting, and we couldn't resist asking Ryan Johnson to participate. Unfortunately, he was nice enough to say yes. Let's go ahead and hear how Ryan formed his list and get his number five.
Film school for me is about watching movies. That's the benefit of film school. It's not about what you're taught in the classroom. It's not about, you know, it's about watching movies and meeting people and making your own movies. And so the idea of having a list of five movies you should watch in film school is kind of, I decided to make it very personal and just say, okay, these are five movies that deeply affected me in film school, and these are the reasons why. Number five, I'm sure with all of these controversy will abound. Number five is Goodfellas, actually, Scorsese's Goodfellas. And for me, it's largely because of technique. For me, if you watch the editing in Goodfellas, that's a film school right there for you. He cuts in that movie like he does with all of his movies, but I think Goodfellas is a particularly good example, and maybe along with After Hours. He cuts film like a jazz drummer, and he cuts based on rhythm rather than based on continuity, and combined with the sound design really is one of the true artists at creating music, visual music with film.
Ryan's number five, Goodfellas. Yeah, can't argue with that. Yeah. It's in my penalty box. It's a movie that we can't mention in our top fives because otherwise I'd put it in every top five list. Right. So Goodfellas is an absolutely great choice. Sam, before we get your number five, what did you use to form your list?
Well, I mean, unlike Ryan Johnson, and even unlike yourself, you went to film school. You could consider yourself a filmmaker. I'm not a filmmaker. I'm a film lover. And most great movies, I think, remind me of why I love watching films. And there are just a few films, and all of these five films meet this criterion, made me want to make something, make a movie, to pick up a camera, grab my friends, and make a movie. And I think some of these films, too, I think all of these films, maybe except for my number one film, make filmmaking look like I could just pick up a camera and grab my friends and make it happen in some way. And there's a sense that these films aren't perfect either, that they allow for a kind of peek behind the camera of filmmaking, and they make it seem possible and fun. And I also used as a criterion that none of the films could rely solely on a charismatic performance or a charismatic script, if you will.
So it has to be the director.
It has to be the director. And all of these films actually on my list are writer-directors.
Okay, interesting.
Finally, and we discussed this too, it's important, this is Film Spotting University, so we would be entirely comfortable screening this film for a classroom full of aspiring filmmakers.
Right, and saying these films inspired us and we think they could and maybe should inspire you as well.
That's right.
Okay, so these films aren't necessarily the greatest five films ever made, not by a long shot.
Not by a long shot.
On my list, I maybe have a couple that I think right. I'd put in that list, but for the most part, it's a more personal list, movies that really inspire us, make us want to make films or just create.
That's
okay,
right.
So you're number five.
Absolutely right. My number five is David Gordon Green's George Washington, his feature film debut, the director of All the Real Girls Under Tow, and this year's Snow Angels coming out later this year. And watching the film, I had a sense of seeing something new, even if Green was heavily influenced by others. Terrence Malick, of course, comes to mind. And it's this film about young, mostly African-American teenagers in a rural North Carolina community. And it really is his love and affection for this small rural community. But also, I think he solves a problem with, you know, small budget, first-time filmmaker, working with non-professional actors. And I recently came across this bit of advice for first-time film directors, and it's, if you're going to be using non-professional actors, don't use a lot of dialogue. It's going to make your whole filmmaking process a lot more difficult. And I think, Green uses voiceover, he uses his camera to just observe these people and their lives, and he really captures a sense of life in this community. And the film really develops this sense of magic realism for me. And I think it's really all these little disparate organic parts that really make it greater than the sum of its parts. And I just really admire the film. And again, it's that sense of watching something new.
Yeah, I admire it a lot as well. My number five, I've cheated here, Sam. I've got a tie, but I don't think anyone can really begrudge me here because they are at least from the same filmmaker. And on my list, I've got to have at least one true art film, a foreign language film here in this case. And the thing I'd want young filmmakers to take away from this really is the way this director, in this case, Michelangelo Antonioni, explores character and does it in a way where we don't have to know every single motivation. La Ventura, his film, though you could also include any of the Alienation trilogy, La Notte and Les Eclipses, but also The Passenger, the Jack Nicholson film The Passenger, which I just saw recently. And I have to say, La Ventura is a film I saw in film school, my first year in film school. It was one of the first ones we had to watch. And no, unfortunately, I can't call myself a filmmaker. I have made some short films. I'm definitely
available
not a filmmaker.
On the film
spotting
website,
I'm definitely not a filmmaker. I did only go to 1 year of film school, but I have made a few films. And the way he captures alienation and these characters being disconnected from the world, in La Ventura, it's not by choice. In The Passenger, it is. They're trying to be disconnected from the world. It's fascinating, and he almost does it all with the visuals, all with the shots, not with the dialogue or the plot. And The Passenger ends with a shot that may be one of the greatest closing long takes I've ever seen.
Wow. All right, well, let's hear Ryan Johnson's number four.
Number four is Annie Hall. And I was actually hopping back and forth between this and The Apartment, weirdly enough, because this one for me is Annie Hall for me is the great modern American comedy, and in terms of a film that is both a great film in terms of the technique and innovative in terms of the narrative use of time in it and just everything involved in it, and yet is absolutely hilarious and poignant and just cuts you to the quick in terms of a heart-rending story. It's a beautiful film. And The Apartment, I feel exactly the same way about. But Annie Hall won. You win, Woody.
Annie Hall, hard to argue, as Rian Johnson says, the great American comedy, perhaps, certainly for a generation of film lovers.
Yeah, Annie Hall, my favorite romantic comedy of all time. I think the funniest movie still I've ever seen. So can't fault him for that choice at all. And also, he mentioned The Apartment in there, a great Billy Wilder film that, he can have a tie. We'll give it to him, The Apartment and Annie Hall.
I have this friend, all right? She's a gynecologist in Hollywood, and she scored this for me from the lab where she works. It's a Madonna pap smear. I know it's kind of cloudy, but it's a Madonna pap smear. It's got Ciccone on the top. That's like a medical label, Ciccone.
All right, that's Teresa Taylor as, according to the credits, pap smear pusher, just one of the more than two dozen characters in Richard Linklater's feature film debut. Another feature film debut. My number four is Richard Linklater's Slacker. And I think what's fascinating about this film, by the end of it, it almost is, looking back on all the characters you've been introduced to, almost all of them, it seems, would be worthy of a full-length film, or at least the story they're engaged in. And again, I think it's a matter of like watching somebody solve a problem by having $23,000 and obviously knows and loves this community. How does he put it on film? And he manages to do it. And I think it's a great achievement, but it's also the kind of thing where you're like, I think I could do that. You know, what I really love about the film is the sincerity with which and the understanding with which he presents these people on screen. And I think clearly Linklater has an amazing ear for dialogue and a very sensitive ear. And I think that's a great lesson for young filmmakers.
Well, anyone out there who thinks Slacker seems like an odd choice for this list, I will point out that during my 1 year as a grad student, we had a theory class that everybody had to take, and Slacker was on the list. It was on the syllabus along with The Godfather and other movies. So I think that's a good choice. My number four is a film that wasn't on my film school syllabus, but is a film I watched that year, my first year there in film school, and had an enormous impact on me. Here's a clip.
I'm going to get married.
To who?
To Anthony.
Terrific. Maria, don't be silly. Anthony's going to college.
Only to play football. When he gets out, he'll be going to work with his father doing construction, and he'll be pulling in a really bitchin' salary. We'll be, like, totally hooked.
Don't smoke in the house.
Besides, he's got to marry me. I'm going to have a baby.
That's a scene from the opening of Hal Hartley's film Trust. And again, I kind of formed my list where I thought about what's the one or two things I want young filmmakers to maybe take away from it, and what did I take away from it? And the big things that really hit me were his irreverence and also the absurdity. Being able to walk this line where you absolutely believe these characters and are interested in them and care about them, yeah, but they're totally absurd and are in totally absurd situations. And that scene I just played, you lose the impact of it listening to it there, because what's amazing is you're seeing the shot that, to me, I had never seen a shot like this before. The opening of the film, it just opens with the sound of birds chirping outside, the credits flash on the screen, and we see a close-up of the lead character, Maria, putting lipstick on her face. It's an extreme close-up, and her mom's right behind her over her shoulder, and you never see the dad until later in the scene, but he's yelling at her the whole time, and then we see him only when she slaps him, and he has a heart attack there on the kitchen floor and dies. And again, it's kind of so absurd, and yet I was just so drawn into it, so much so that when I had to make my film at the end of the year, I totally ripped Trust off. I made my beginning of the film just like the beginning of Trust, where I had, you know, just these characters thrown right into a scene like they're talking to you. I had the credits flashing on screen the way he did it. I totally ripped it off. So, you know, again, I had to put a film on this list that obviously had that kind of an influence on me that I wanted to steal it. So,
well, you talk about Hartley, one of those few filmmakers that it's able and consistently creates his own world on film, where the rules of that world don't apply really to our world. And I think it's a good setup for Rian Johnson's number three.
Number three is Barton Fink, actually. And I'm going to cheat a little and say I was going back and forth between this and basically anything that David Lynch has done. And for me, what this was for me. Barton Fink was kind of the first movie that I sat down and watched 20 times when I got to film school. And it's the fact that it is a completely original, self-contained piece of work. It's not based on a novel. It's not based on, you know, it's a film, and it's a film that is thematically dense and complicated, and you can watch over and over and get more and more out of it. It's a film with at least the complexity of a great novel.
And you said it perfectly there, Sam. This is an amazing world the Coen brothers have created in Barton Fink, John Turturro, and of course he's a screenwriter out in Hollywood, right. So you'd expect a guy like Rian Johnson would have a film like that on his list. Let's go ahead and hear your number three.
All right, my number three, we just finished a Herzog Kinski marathon just a little bit ago. We watched five of his films, one of his documentaries. And for me, I'm telling young filmmakers to put together a Herzog marathon all their own. I want them to see Aguirre, Nosferatu, Fitzcarraldo, and Cobra Verde. And I think it's because all of these films are imperfect in their own way. They're all a little indulgent. None of them are entirely satisfying for me personally. But watching the four of them, watching the first four, Aguirre, Nosferatu, Wojciech, Fitzcarraldo, Cobra Verde, there's five in there actually, it changed how I watched films, but it also changed how I was. It also changed my perspective just on the world itself, you know, just in terms of how I was perceiving things and seeing things. And it really is his ability to capture the natural suspense of life just by putting an actor in a situation or a scenario that he's uncomfortable with physically, all of a sudden created a suspense, keeping his camera rolling. And he and his cinematographer create several moments like that in every one of their films. And I think really it's repeated exposure to Herzog, which will change the way maybe you make films, future filmmakers of the world, but for me, how I watch films.
I think it certainly would, and if you read the article about him, the great profile in The New Yorker, for example, that ran a while back, if you can get your hands on that, they talk about how Hollywood people try to make films with him, and they don't know what he's doing. They totally undermine him the whole time, and they think he's crazy, and he doesn't know how to make
films.
It's
like there's only 30 years of evidence here.
Right, exactly, and yet he has his own system, and it works pretty damn brilliantly. So anyway, my number three is a filmmaker who had a tremendous influence on Rian Johnson, and has a little bit of that absurd factor that Hal Hartley had in my last choice, but mainly the surrealism is what really drew me to David Lynch and Blue Velvet. Everything is so sharp and so heightened, and you've got, though, essentially a detective story, which is what allows you to hang on for the ride, even though you've got characters doing things, Dennis Hopper's character doing things, behaving in a way that I don't know I've ever seen any character in the history of film, you know, behave that way. And I remember seeing it late in high school, around the same time I saw a movie like Reservoir Dogs, which could have made my list, had a big impact on me. And I was stupid enough to think that this movie's so amazing, Blue Velvet, this is so amazing that everybody has to see this film. I'd invite friends over who really aren't into film at all, right. And I was just really getting into it. And I'd
welcome
expect
to my
that,
world.
Yeah, that they'd be able to realize the brilliance of this film. And, you know, their eyes just glazed over, and they couldn't believe I was making them watch something so kind of depraved and out there. But when you have that detective story and around it all this craziness, I just have to say, for me, it makes total sense. In the same way a movie like Mulholland Drive makes sense to me, and it's something you can't really articulate. But Lynch's world does work for me, and again, I want filmmakers, young filmmakers, maybe to see that they can be absurd and they can be totally surreal, and yet it doesn't have to feel so out there like a movie like Lost Highway of Lynch's, which is just incomprehensible. You know, you can walk that line.
Or maybe it's just a matter of following their personal vision in some way.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's probably,
that's it.
In some ways, Lynch makes very personal movies.
He does.
It's
his
not
own
personal to anyone else.
Fevered dreams.
Exactly.
You know?
Which I think, again, will help us set up Rian Johnson's number two.
Number two is Brazil. And I kind of have a specific reason for this. There's, on one hand, the invention in that film just gets you incredibly excited about grabbing a camera and going and making a movie. The amount of stuff that Gilliam fits into every single frame just is like hooking electrodes up to your brain. It's amazing. At the same time, for me at least, it was the first film where I realized I can't do that with the resources that I have, and made me realize kind of made me have that kind of hunger to get more resources and realize that once you got those resources, they didn't have to be restrictions. They could be used to jam even more stuff into the frame and kind of make you. It's the first kind of thing that made me wish that, you know, made you see the potential of greater resources, I guess.
Brazil, not a film I know you're a huge fan of.
I'm not.
But I certainly admire. But now I'll get to my number two, which is a completely personal choice. And it is, I can say, without reservation, that this movie changed my life. Not because of the content, but for the fact that I saw it and my life thereafter changed. And it is Quentin Tarantino's Kill Bill. I just happened to see these films. I waited to see Kill Bill 1 until it was on DVD. Kill Bill Volume 2 was already out in the movie theater, so I watched Kill Bill Volume 1 on DVD. Went the next night to see Volume 2. On my way home from seeing Volume 2, I realized I needed to quit my job and I needed to start making things instead of marketing for regional shopping malls, basically, is what it comes down to. And I think what it is about watching the film, or what it was for me watching Kill Bill Volume 2, was the joy of watching someone who loves movies make a movie. And I think I am an admirer of all of Tarantino's work, but particularly this, there's a joy. Even if the subject matter is down and dirty and bloody, there's a joy in the way he films Uma Thurman. There's a joy in which he stages every single one of those scenes, the way he choreographs it. And yes, it changed my life. I gave my notice at my job 2 days later. And it's probably one of the reasons I'm here sitting on the mic
absolutely.
And talking to you.
Yeah.
So will that have the effect on every young filmmaker? No, but I think there is a value in watching somebody. And I think it comes across. I mean, Quentin Tarantino is many things, but he is not cynical. He's not cynical about movie making.
Mm-mm.
And I think the joy that's expressed here, I think you might catch the fever.
It's a great choice. My number two is a film that is close to Rian Johnson's heart, I know. And here it's a film I think every young filmmaker needs to see, a genre film, and especially if they can watch one that deconstructs a genre as well as Chinatown does. And I know this is a film, my last two are going to be choices that are kind of those obvious, they're going to be on those big lists that people put together of the best films ever, not like Trust, you know, for example, but taking a genre like Robert Town and Roman Polanski do, and then ultimately turning it on its head from the main character, Jake Gittes, and then to the level of depravity it goes. We see in these movies characters lusting after money. You know, you watch something like Chinatown, it's much deeper and more evil than that. And the way you take a genre, update it, make it relevant to the 70s, transform the conventions of the genre, Chinatown is one of my all-time favorite films.
All right, I think these last couple of slots here between you and me and Rian Johnson are going to be filled with some heavyweights.
Some heavyweights, yeah.
So let's go to Rian Johnson's number one.
Number one for me is 8.5. And for me, again, this is kind of going to be a poofy explanation for it, but for me, it was the first movie that I truly fell in love with and not appreciated and not got into and not became a fan of, but fell in love with the way that you sometimes can fall in love with a woman, as goofy as that sounds, but just absolutely became absorbed in every element of it, the look of it, the feel of it, the music, the way the women looked in it, the way, you know, those sunglasses looked on him, and at every element of the movie, to where it became greater than the sum of its parts, to the point where a movie really becomes something in your life that you can linger on, that you can come back to, and mean something much more for you than just shadow and light up on a screen.
And that is Fellini's 8.5. And Fellini, you know, that is a great choice. You can go with a lot of films. Another film about a filmmaker.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can expect that. And, of course, Knights of Cabiria is a film we both love. Could have been on my list easily.
Yeah.
La Strada.
Narrowly,
lots of great films. So, again, we want to thank Rian Johnson for all of his input. And I hope that we hope that you enjoyed hearing from a filmmaker what films really had the biggest influence on him.
And I love that way he describes, like, the first film he falls in love
mm-hmm.
with. I mean, I think we all have those movies. And
I think this is maybe even it for me a little bit.
Yeah.
So go ahead and give your number
all
one.
All right, my number one, it really is. It's the film, it's Yoshihiro Ozu's Tokyo Story. It's the film that gave birth to this list, or can be blamed for this list,
right,
if you'd like to put it that way. Very simple story. Elderly couple leave their small coastal village to make the long journey to visit their children in Tokyo. Their children largely ignore them. And really the way that Ozu just captures this. And I it's very difficult, I think, to articulate the patience with which he depicts these relationships, these people, the simplicity of the dialogue, the everyday language. And it's the only film on my list that is a perfect film, as far as I can tell. It's the kind of movie, if you make it your goal to match its perfection, you will likely make better films because of it, because you will likely fail, but just the effort, the sheer effort in trying to capture the simplicity, almost the Zen simplicity
mm-hmm.
of this film and the perfection of it, you're going to make good films. And it's just deeply beautiful, simple, and moving.
And, you know, a great counterpart to a film like Kill Bill, which couldn't be more
yeah.
kinetic and hyperactive, and then watch a film like Tokyo Story,
yeah.
watch them together, because
yeah.
then you watch that, and there are literally two camera movements in the entire film. That's
true.
It. Otherwise, it's all stationary. My number one is the film that has to be the number one because what I want young filmmakers to see in it, the virtuosity of it. It's that brilliant. And it is Martin Scorsese's Raging Bull. The first movie I watched, probably other than The Godfather, which is a movie I grew up watching on TV and liking. So I kind of always knew everyone loved it and it was kind of a masterpiece. But Raging Bull was the first film where I was into movies and I sat down and said, I get that term now. I know why people call this a masterpiece. The virtuosity of the camera work and the editing, the way the boxing scenes are absolutely brutal to watch and yet somehow like a ballet. They have tremendous grace. Everything about the look of the film is amazing, and that's my number one.
It's obviously a great pick. I remember seeing it the second time myself, and it was the first time I noticed over the credits, like the huffing of the bull.
Uh-huh.
It turns the whole thing into a kind of poetry
it does.
In some way.
Yeah.
It's a really nice touch. It's a great film, obviously, and that is our top five. Please send your top five entries into the Film Spotting University syllabus or any other feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message. We'll be back next month with another top five and more reviews of new and recently released movies right here on Chicago Public Radio. In the meantime, go to filmspotting.net and listen to the weekly Film Spotting podcast.
Next week on our podcast, we'll review Invincible with Mark Wahlberg and Greg Kinnear and share our top five movies that make us cry.
I can't wait for that.
I can't wait. This radio edition of Film Spotting is presented by Chicago Public Radio with editorial assistance from Christina Stevens and Joe Dassault. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Van Halgren. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
In the wealthy seaside community of Neptune, the rich and powerful make the rules. They own the town and the high school and desperately try to keep all their dirty little secrets hidden. Unfortunately for them, there's Veronica Mars. By day, Veronica is another senior at Neptune High School, but at night she helps with her father's private investigator business, solving the town's toughest mysteries. Discover Veronica Mars, Season 2, now on DVD.
Welcome back to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Halgren. Adam, let's take a
you
quick...
Sam Halgren. Why did I stop you?
I don't know.
Why did I stop you? Should have just let you go.
Yeah. All right. Welcome back to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Halgren. I'm Sam Van Halgren, damn it.
No, you're not. Apparently not.
Damn it.
You don't know who you are, Sam.
It's a crisis. I'm having a crisis. All right.
Oh, yeah. There was going to be like the top five films.
Can you hear us?
Oh, hey.
Hey.
There they are.
Sorry. We've been listening to you for the last 5 minutes.
Let me step out of the room so you guys
have Oh, no. You heard all the nasty stuff we've been saying about you.
That's right.
Oh, good God.
This was all intentional.
So awkward.
We've got the goods.
Ryan Johnson is really a jerk. Listen to Film Spotting.
It's all on tape.
It's not a news story at all. Not a news flash at all, actually.